Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find them on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Mike Torr, environmental reporter for the Contra Costa Times, and your moderator for tonight's program. The Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta is a key source of water for much California. In recent years, record amounts of water were pumped out of the Delta, and a tipping point appears to have been reached. For a whole host of reasons, several kinds of fish have collapsed. After 150 years, salmon fishing was closed off the coast of California last year for the first time. It was closed again this year. Delta smelt, longfin smelt, green sturgeon, Central Valley steelhead, two runs of salmon, Puget Sound killer whales are all, according to regulators, threatened in some degree by the use of Delta water. In response, we have new rules in place that are curtailing water use, and there's a flurry of lawsuits that are being filed. How do we get out of this mess? The plan being pushed by state government and some of the big water agencies in the state is to build a canal around the Delta as part of a large habitat restoration and conservation project. Even if the plan is adopted, it is certain to take many years and cost billions of dollars. It's also fairly certain to be controversial and lead to more lawsuits. So please welcome our panel of experts as we explore these issues and more. Our panelists are Gregory Gartrell, PhD, and Assistant General Manager for Water Resources at the Contra Costa Water District. Richard Howitt, Department Chair and Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis. And Mark Schlossberg, California Director of Food and Water Watch. Originally, a representative of the California State Water Resources Control Board, which administers state water rights and water quality laws in California, agreed to participate in the discussion, but had a last-minute scheduling conflict and, unfortunately, will not be joining us tonight. Okay, on to the discussion. Let's begin with Greg Gartrell. Greg, your water district, which supplies water to 500,000 people, is effectively at the bottom of the Delta and therefore more sensitive to changes in Delta water quality than perhaps any other water district. As you know, plans to build a peripheral canal to get water from the Sacramento River to the San Joaquin Valley, Southern California, and other points south of the Delta are moving quickly. Can you explain for us how such a canal might affect the Contra Costa Water District and its customers?
Yeah, and well, the simple answer is yes, and I will. But you have to, it's a multiple part question, and you have to start to understand it. You have to understand that what is being proposed today is not the same thing that was proposed in 1982. Had the peripheral canal been built in 1982, probably been in the same mess that we are now with both water quality and species, because the rules that were proposed at that time would have driven us to pretty much the same thing. The difference is this time is that a different set of rules are being proposed, and the reason it's a multiple-part question is that there are three or four different sets of rules. And depending on which rules on how it gets operated differ on the answer. At one end are those proposed by water users, and not surprisingly, those are the least stringent in terms of requiring flows in the Delta and flows for fisheries and allow the most water to be exported. And at the other end of the spectrum are those being proposed by the Department of Fish and Game, Fish and Wildlife Service, and environmental interests that require more flows for fisheries. Now, the more flow you have in the system up to a point, the better the water quality is. So for us, for Contra Costa Water District, if you come up with a set of rules that have reasonable restrictions for water users and reasonable restrictions to protect fisheries, there might not be much of a change. On the other hand, if you go through a process and come up with a set of rules that primarily require water use from a peripheral canal and very little export from the southern delta as we have now, you have a whole different situation. And that's because while we have a two-river system, one from the Sacramento and one from the San Joaquin, it's fundamentally been changed by the state and federal water projects and local water projects on the San Joaquin side. And that river is no longer really a river 90% of the time. It's a drain. And that drainage water coming into the Delta with the absence of water moving through the system from the north to the south essentially turns the southern delta into a cesspool where you have tidal flows sloshing the water back and forth, and the drainage and the pollutants in it accumulate. And that's still on the table as one of the alternatives. So depending on how those rules get set up and how it's operated, can be dramatically different for both water quality for Contra Costa Water District customers as well as the environment. But the thing that our district is most concerned about right now is that the situation we are in is untenable and unsustainable. And the focus on a project that is going to take a minimum of 10 years and probably more like 15 or 20 years to get through all the lawsuits and the environmental documentation and the permitting and to get built. I mean, it's a four-year construction project. So even if they had all the permits and everybody agreed today, it would be 4 years. That the situation we have now today with both the fisheries and for water supplies is just unsustainable for the state. And there are near-term actions that can be taken that are not being taken yet to alleviate that. And that, I think, is the most critical thing that is occurring right now that is affecting everyone.
Thanks, Greg. Dr. Richard Howitt, you were one of the co-authors of a report last year by the Public Policy Institute of California. It was a pretty influential report. And it recommended a peripheral canal, potentially a very large one. And I'm sure you didn't have in mind the options that would lead to a cesspool in the lower part of the delta. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about why the PPIC concluded that a peripheral canal was the best option, and if you want to address how it might be run to avoid the worst outcomes, that would be welcome too.
Certainly. Yes. I was part of a team of seven people who we've written two books now on the Delta. And as an economist, it pains me to tell you that they're free. and so you can download the PDFs at ppic.org if you wish. And there's also 500 pages of appendices of technical models and stuff. For those of you who are fish enthusiasts or economic enthusiasts or engineering enthusiasts. But fundamentally, we came up with some interesting ideas, some of which I think we see eye to eye completely with Greg on, and others we perhaps differ slightly. One of the really surprising things to me is that I went into this project. We all went into this project because we were disillusioned with the CalFed process, which did not allow people to look at certain options. You were not funded if you wanted to look at a peripheral canal. You were not funded if you wanted to look at cutting exports to zero. So we did our studies without funding because, and strange to say, there are some benefits of tenure occasionally. Came to the conclusion, and we started with this idea of co-equal objectives, that, yes, if you shut the whole system down, the fish would like it better. But California runs on energy, information, and water. And our economy is unique, and we're a post-industrial economy, because we move those commodities to where people like to use them. We don't use them where they are. We move them. And we move them through public network systems. And our public network system, as Greg pointed out, is in dire danger in the Delta. There is a 64% probability of a total collapse of the Delta within the next 50 years, either for earthquake or from flood. Nobody really disputes that. The whole system can collapse. Seawater will rush in. This is an engineering scenario which you can download if you want to have a look at it. It's called the Big Gulp. And the sea rushes in, salts the system up, shuts the whole system down, destroys the ecology. And it takes a long time to get that salt out of the South Delta. But one of the really interesting surprises that I got was one time when I was bemoaning what I call Jones Tract economics. Jones Tract, an island levee, collapsed 4 years ago now because an errant beaver drilled in the wrong direction, and it collapsed in July. And our governor flew down there and said, fix it, which they did very effectively. but at a cost of 100 million, between 80 and 100 million to the taxpayer. This is for a piece of private real estate that you can buy. Personally, you can buy it now for about 21 to 18 million. So I was whining about that. And my biology colleague said, but we don't want to have the Delta fresh all the time. Our problem is that our native California estuary species are suffering for many, many reasons. But one of them is, that, as one of my biology colleagues tells me, if you turn the water quality and the salinity of a California estuary into the same temperature and salinity as a lake in southern Arkansas, you get southern Arkansas species. The ecology, is, for me, is relatively simple. What we've done in the last 90 years is we've twisted the delta because we've used it for a water delivery system. And I suddenly realized that fluctuating salinity, I'm not talking about salinizing the delta completely, but letting it go back to an annual fluctuation, is in fact not detrimental to the California species. To the invasive species, it is. But that's exactly what we want to do. So we anticipate a canal, and we haven't specified quite what it would be, although we can talk, get into some details. It would be a lot smaller than the previous one, which would decouple water supply from ecosystem management in the delta. At the same time, it should be run such that the environmental interests have a proportion of that canal for themselves. And this will be an environmental asset that can be used to build environmental rehabilitation. So not to go on too long, we started with a completely, and the books analyze the options of doing nothing, doing a canal, doing a big canal, small canal, a through delta system, and walking away from the system and letting it collapse over the next 50 years. And we analyze them from an ecological point of view and an economic point of view.
Thank you. Mark Schlossberg. Mark, when we talk about California being parched, it appears that is true in parts of the state and less true in other parts. Urban water agencies are mostly enduring what's a modest drought with modest water rationing plans. Agriculture, which uses four times as much water as all of California's cities and suburbs combined, does face some pretty serious difficulties in some regions, especially Westlands Water District, the Kern County Water Agency. Do you think that California is dedicating too much of its water for food?
I don't think it's a question of giving too much or too little to particular issues. I think the issue is that across the board, we need to look at measures that allow us to better use our water and better conserve our water and use it in smarter ways. There was a report that was issued by the Pacific Institute a few months ago that talked about ways in which agriculture could save water by switching to different types of crops and better irrigating their crops in some cases. There's also lots of studies that have been done talking about ways in which consumers in urban areas can also save water and reduce water consumption. Food and Water Watch is a consumer organization, and we're concerned about the promotion of industrial water supply production options such as desalination that really are very energy intensive and very costly to the consumer. When we could be investing in conservation, in fixing system leaks, in efficiencies, in using the water that we have in smarter ways, that's better for consumers and better for the environment without having to cost taxpayers and ratepayers hundreds of millions or billions of dollars for new industrial projects. So what we're concerned about as Food and Water Watch is that we should be using our water in a smarter way, both in rural and urban areas, and that we should be looking as a society to investing more in conservation, using native landscape, using our water smarter in agriculture rather than these big industrial projects.
Good. Thanks, Mark. First question I want to read from the audience is not for any one of you, but would like to hear your thoughts. The question is, I understand that drinking water is becoming more scarce than oil. What do you think?
No.
No, I would agree with that.
What are you selling drinking water for, Greg, per 330,000 gallons?
That would be for an acre foot. It's about completely treated for potable uses is about $1,200 an acre foot.
So we can buy 330,000 gallons for $1,200, and I paid $270 to put gas in my car.
This is Mark Schlossberg. I think it depends on your perspective and what you're purchasing. If you purchase a bottle of water at a grocery store produced by Nestle, Coca-Cola, yeah, PepsiCo, or any of the others, you're paying more for water than you are for a gallon of gas. And you should be able to get this, and you can get it, basically the same product out of your tap for pennies on the dollar. That's one of the reasons why Food and Water Watch is working against bottled water or encouraging people to take back the tap, promoting tap water over bottled water. When you talk about water being the new oil, it's not when you're talking about getting out of the tap. It is when you're talking about large corporations going after water resources, our most precious water resources, trying to purchase them, control them, and then sell them to consumers at exorbitant prices. And so we're very encouraging people to support their municipal water systems and to support legislation at the state and federal level, particularly at the federal level, to create a clean water trust fund to strengthen our water infrastructure, which is aging and in desperate need of repair, both in California and throughout the country, so that we don't have to result in a situation where people are paying more for a bottle of water than they are for a gallon of gasoline.
Okay. Yeah, just to make that comparison again, a gallon of gas, you know what that you pay for that, a couple of, you know, $3 now, you're less than a penny a gallon on water. Okay. If you get it out of the tap. If you buy it at the store, well, you're more than gasoline. So
yeah. You can spend a couple dollars a quart, I think, at the store if you want. And where did you get gasoline for $2.70?
Davis. Things are cheap in Davis.
Here's a question about desalination, and people often look to that as an answer. The question is, pebble bed reactors have proven to be a safe alternative for powering desalinization plants and to provide electricity. Should this technology be used to supply fresh water to Southern California instead of taking our water? I know, Greg Gartrell, you have a pilot. I don't think it uses this technology, but you have a pilot desalination project going on.
Yeah, we do jointly with East Bay Municipal Utility District, Santa Clara Valley Water District, and San Francisco Public Utilities Commission. But there is one fundamental issue always with desalination, and that's fundamental physics. It takes a lot of energy to take the salt back out of the water. You're never going to get around that. So it's always going to be one of the last choices. It's right up there. There are plenty of recycling projects that are far more expensive. Not so much for the treatment of the water for recycling, but you can't put recycled water in treated water, potable water pipelines. You have to put in the infrastructure for that, and that can be very, very expensive. So those two are always going to be at the high end. Those are always going to be your last choices. And then until you get off a carbon based energy system, I think you're always going to have problems with greenhouse gases related to desalination.
There's an additional problem with desal, and that is that the brine disposal represents significant environmental problems in many places. And if you have a 2 mile long, the current plant that's being engineered in Carlsbad has, I don't know how long the pipe is, but it goes way out. But even then, there's some marine ecologists who are saying, I'm not sure, you know, this highly concentrated brine shooting into the sea might cause problems. But again, look what people did. Santa Barbara purchased a desal plant used in 1993, I think, maybe 1992. They ran it for a while in the 90s drought, and then it got too expensive. Too expensive for Santa Barbara? If something's too expensive for Santa Barbara, it's too expensive, period. And they're at the end of the line. They're by the sea. They've got disposal, and I don't think they've got cheap houses. So, yes, there are times in which it can be used, and one would love to have a technological breakthrough. But as Greg points out, there's a fundamental energy problem.
One other thing with desal. There are over 20 desalination facilities being planned up and down California's coast. And some of them are being co-located with power plants that you rely on outdated ones through cooling technology, which has a significant impact on the local marine environment. There's a big facility that Poseidon Resources, a private corporation, is planning to place in Huntington Beach, which would be co-located with a power facility that is currently on schedule to be phased out, the technology that they're relying on. And putting a power desal facility co-locating with that could actually end up prolonging the use of this outdated technology. Not only that, but when you have talking about private corporations doing the desalination, it allows them to set the market for the desalinated water, which is dangerous because it's not a publicly accountable entity. It's a private corporation. On the energy point, I can't emphasize that enough. There's other desal facilities under consideration in the Bay Area. There's one that's being considered a 5 million gallon per day facility, or to 15 in Marin. And we recently commissioned a study by a former conservation manager of Marin, James Fryer, who looked at the alternatives to desal, the cost of desalination, and came up with a menu of options that included conservation measures like efficient toilets and clothes washers, gray water, which is becoming easier now in California or is slated to become easier in California, and irrigation landscape reform, really providing real incentives for people to change their landscaping. That is a huge, huge consumer of drinking water in California. And the more we can phase out really water-intensive plants and phase in more drought-resistant native plants, the better off we'll be in our water situation.
Thanks, Mark. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're talking with a panel of experts about the future of water policy in California. Our panelists are Gregory Gartrell, PhD and Assistant General Manager for Water Resources for the Contra Costa Water District; Richard Howitt, Department Chair and Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis; and Mark Schlossberg, California Director of Food and Water Watch. I think this would be a good question for you, Richard Howitt. You did a study earlier this year talking about unemployment in the San Joaquin Valley as a result of the drought, and since then we've had some rain. The question is, all of you talk about the environment. How about the thousands of people who are out of work in the Central Valley because the environment has cut off water for crops?
Thank you. Yes, it's an important and worrying question, because there's no question that there are significant communities and socioeconomic groups who are really suffering because of the lack of water. Now, the first thing to be sure of is that if you take the Department of Water Resources model runs, they show that only 20% of the total cut can be ascribed to the smelt regulations that Judge Wanger promulgated this last year. So, but the trouble is that because of the way the priority water laws are structured, that 20% hits in a very particular concentrated part, i.e. the west side of the valley, which is very productive. And there's no question that large acreages, my models show 220,000 acres out in Westlands, another 120,000 out in the Kern County, and overall about 400,000 out, which is maps into about 35,000 jobs. Now, there's been, and that's not just farm jobs; that's jobs that run throughout the country, the communities. So, there's no question that the land is out of production, that these people in these communities are facing extremely high unemployment rates, partially triggered initially by the construction downturn, and then on top of this, they've had an agricultural downturn. And we should be, as citizens of California, we should be very concerned about the social impacts of our water policies.
Okay, thank you. The next question is a great question and a classic one that we've heard for a long time, which is, why are our farmers growing high water use crops like rice, cotton, alfalfa, et cetera? And to that, I'd add that this has been a criticism for a long time. You know, environmentalists especially have been hammering on farmers to grow higher value, less water intensive crops. than rice, cotton, and alfalfa. And driving down I-5, it appears that that's happening. You see cotton fields that are orchards now. The trouble it seems to be in a drought, you can't fallow an orchard like you can a cotton field. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the panel about crop use patterns and the way we use agricultural water, which is the biggest, you know, water user in the state. Who wants to start? Yeah, go ahead, Greg. Greg
Bartrell. That is a good question. I give the issue really comes down to what's called in the business demand hardening. I'll give you an example that some of you may have lived with in the last year or two, as we've asked for conservation within our water district and neighboring agencies have as well. If you put in a ultra-low flush toilet and then try to save water by not flushing, you only save a gallon and a half, whereas if you had a wasteful toilet, you'd save 7.5. If you're a farmer and you put in trees and vines in a drip system, when the drought comes along and you still get cut, you're losing a very, very valuable crop. It took you years to build up, and you have a big investment in. So the consequences of drought and cutbacks become more acute the more efficient you become, and the necessity of getting through those becomes even greater. So it's a difficult problem. It's going to be a difficult problem for everybody. I think one of the things we're learning as they do these studies for the future conveyance, whatever it might be, through the Delta or around the Delta, is that in the dry years, all the canal can do is move the water you have. You don't get more water in dry years than you do now. In fact, this year it would have been worse had they had the scenario where you only take water from peripheral canal. That canal would have been, no matter how big it was they're planning on, would have been empty. It wouldn't have been moving any water between December 1st and mid-February when it really started to rain. Well, during that time period, they moved several hundred thousand acre feet to the south. So the kind of critical situation they have in Westland's Water District would have been absolutely worse under that scenario. The problem is, as we grow and become more efficient, we're also going to have to find ways to store water or find ways to shift water around during those critical periods.
Back to the question.
The farmers grow the crops they grow because they are businessmen and they are the best thing to do with that water and that land in that year. Farmers are very effective businessmen. The ones who are not long ago disappeared. And there is, of course, a general trend, and we can show it, but we used to grow, basically we get two-thirds of our agricultural revenue off about one-third of the acres, and that's moving up steadily as the markets expand. And there's no question that when you come back, when your children come back in 50 years' time and look at the valley, they'll see far more fruit, nuts, vegetables, vines, and so on, because that's what we're growing. California agriculture is a high employment type of agriculture. It generates jobs. It generates communities. And the farmers are really very good at figuring out what to do with their restricted water supplies. Therefore, if you go up north of here, the Sacramento Valley, where there's heavy soil, unsuited for many crops, but plentiful water supplies based on historical precedents and environmental flows, then you're growing rice. And that is an effective and efficient thing to do, although they would, under some circumstances, sell their water to people further south. If you go to Westlands this year, you'll see almost no cotton. Cotton acreage is down from 750,000 to down to about 100,000 probably. So I would put in a plug for the farmers, and I would argue that the farmers, like many other people, are good at their business and understand what it is to be short of water.
When you raise this issue, it's about gets back to the kind of the first question, one of the first questions you asked about how much water is going to agriculture. Is it sufficient? And is there room for improvement in efficiency? And I think that, you know, the recent drought may be causing some of that as a market reaction. At the same time, I still think that, as has been documented in several reports, the demand is not solid. There's room for improvement. And I think that that government policy should facilitate greater efficiencies. And, you know, you asked about, you know, is too much going to agriculture versus urban areas? And we've heard discussion about the workers. And I think that one thing that really needs to be emphasized is the quality of the water for the workers and the quality of the water that they have. And the quality of the water in parts of the valley is some of the worst quality of water that there is. There's communities in the South Valley that is undrinkable. And so when we're talking about water conveyances and transfers to the Central Valley and who's the beneficiary of this water, I think we need to keep in mind the workers, not just in terms of their jobs, but also in terms of the water that they're able to consume. They shouldn't have to be put in a situation where they have to buy a bottle of water and they can't drink the water that's from the tap. And that's the situation in some communities.
So in other words, we fixed the Delta water down there, but the guys that live there got to buy it from Nestle or somebody like that.
Yeah. So that's the situation we'd like to avoid.
Yeah. Okay. It's another good question. And could you, when you answer, identify yourself so I don't have to interrupt and say this is so-and-so. It appears that a 1.5 to 2-meter rise in sea level is a given. I don't know about that, but the sea level rise is something that we're looking at with a warming climate. Will this make a difference in the political thinking about behind this canal? Is the canal obsolete before it's even begun? Greg, you want to start with that one?
Well, I think that it already has made a political difference. But you're dealing with an issue that is probably, you know, at least 50 years out before you get anywhere near that. I think most of the predictions are about 1 to 3 feet between 50 and 100 years. Now, what that has they're still trying to work out what that's going to mean in terms of the delta. Certainly in terms of the levees, they're more vulnerable to failure as you have higher and higher pressure. Guys that live in the delta will tell you, well, we'll just pile up more dirt and deal with it as it comes along. That doesn't solve the seismic issue, that if we do have a seismic event that knocks down the levees, that we could be in a terrible situation right away. In terms of the flooding from a flood event, it's a little bit different situation. We've had that multiple levee failures in the delta many times during floods. The difference between a blue sky kind of failure they had in Jones Tract a couple of years ago, well, even in that case, they did not have severe salinity intrusion like they did one time in 1972. And a flood event is, with a flood event, there's a lot of fresh water coming down the system and the islands fill up with fresh water. You don't have the system shut down scenario under that. But that is going to become more and more likely. You're going to lose more and more islands. At that point, you make a decision on what you do with those islands. Now, in the case of Jones Tract, while the property may have been, you know, $20 million, you can buy it for $20 million, there's an awful lot of infrastructure going through that. Those who live in the East Bay Municipal Utility District, for example, get your water across that island. There are a couple of aqueducts that run through there. There's a railroad that runs through there. It's right adjacent to Highway 4 that moves a lot of goods. So there were a lot of reasons for the state to fix that other than just the value it had to that farmer.
Sea level rise is the driving force. In fact, I have a line. It's a bit flippant, but if you say the canal's about politics, no, it's about physics. Because sea level rise, regardless of what you think about global climate change, the sea level is going to rise, and it's going to rise significantly. When you think about the delta as an interface between salt water and fresh water, determined by the flows of fresh water and the sea level and the tides, then as sea level rise goes up, there is no question that the frontier at certain times of the year, at any time of the year, will be further inland than it was before. And if you want to check the engineering studies, and we've done them initially, first of all, if you build an effective medium-sized canal, you will reduce the salt burden export to the valley by 600,000 tons a year now. And we are shipping in 1.5 million tons of salt in our water. We take clean water in the Sacramento River. We mix it with salt in the Delta and send it south to people who want it clean. Does that make any sense? No. So right away, there is a big benefit in water quality if we build it now. And as the sea level rises, and as this X2 frontier between fresh and salt water pushes further inland, the number of days in which you can convey water through the Delta, even with today's bad salinity standards, falls precipitously. The Delta as a water conveyance process is going to be out of business in about 50, 60 years.
Just one point about sea level rise. This is Mark again, Schlossberg.
Thank you.
Food and Water Watch. I think this is an important point when considering not just the canal, which was a question was about, but also these desalination facilities, because they are very energy intensive. And if we're talking about trying to deal with climate change in rising sea levels as a result of climate change, it makes absolutely no sense to invest hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in facilities that are going to double, in some cases, triple the energy use of certain water districts to produce the desalinated water. At the same time, it also discourages things that we need to be investing in, like conservation, because all that money that's being spent on the desalination facilities will need to be repaid, and it'll only be repaid by people buying the water. So it's kind of a catch-22, and instead of focusing on those kind of things, we should be focusing on investing in conservation.
Okay. Thank you. There are a bunch of questions here about what they call governance, basically how, given the fact that the legislature can't pass a budget, or given the fact that we've got all of these problems with complying with regulations. In fact, I watched a webcast today about a saltwater standard that was set in the 70s and hasn't been complied with yet, and there was a drop-dead deadline next week, and they want to push it a little farther. Given those kinds of problems, there's clearly a lack of trust in government to come up with a solution. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how we might deal with that.
Yeah, Mark.
I think that is a key issue. And as one who's been working in this business in the Delta for over 20 years, I don't know the solution. I don't think anybody really does. Any law you pass can be changed. Any contract you write can be changed by law. I've seen proposals where you have multiple contracts and laws, and they still, when push comes to shove, we have standards in the Delta, and every time we get into a drought, the state board finds a reason not to enforce them. We saw that this last February, where the standards for salinity were not met. We saw it in the last drought. I think that is one of the key issues for those who are concerned about what the Delta is going to look like after you build all these facilities and have them the situation where you have a $10 billion facility and a bunch of farmers in Metropolitan Water District, Southern California, and others saying, hey, we're spending all this money and we can't get water through. That's not right. It just compounds the kind of situation you have now where they have an aqueduct goes all the way to Southern California and they can't fill it. And their complaint is, well, we have contracts, we've built all this stuff, we're paying $1 billion a year, and we can't get water. I think that's a problem that I really haven't seen a solution to.
I don't have any magic bullets, but I think that the way to go to start down this track is with a public-private partnership, recognizing that any facility will have a public component, which will be environmental and safety and quality, and a private component where water is sent to municipal or agricultural uses to make money. And the way I would set it up, and we're starting to research whether this is feasible, would be instead of in the past we've optimally sized these dams and canals and then asked people to pay for them, and they're reluctant to do so because they realize, well, you've already built it. So what one would do is to the public would guarantee to build a certain proportion of this canal and then put the rest out for bid. And you would bid not for water but for canal capacity. And it would run much the same way as the natural gas pipelines go. I don't know whether you've looked at the grid of the gas pipelines that feed California houses and industry, but we have three major pipelines coming in. And nobody cares about the gas ownership. Who cares about the gas ownership? It's the share in the pipeline that really the utilities want to buy. And every day it's traded. And so I see, conceptually, I know water is not gas and there's many other factors. But if we put a sector in the public domain and tell the private guys, hey, bid the contract and then live by the contract, and the contract is for conveyance capacity, not water, you decide what to do with it. I think it's got a possibility of working.
Mark Schlossberg with Food and Water Watch. I think that taking water out of public hands and putting it up for bid is not the right way to go. We've seen in other situations, municipalities that have private companies running their water systems, their rates are always higher because there's a profit motive that for-profit companies have. The government, at least, is accountable to the people, and private corporations aren't. Water is a public trust. Water is necessary for human life. It's necessary for our agriculture. It's necessary for human existence. And it's such a precious resource, and we have so little of it in California, that we need to make sure that the government holds it as a public trust. Now, the government has not done a very good job of doing that in the past, and there's a lot of problems, which we see. But that's not a reason to throw the baby out with the bathwater, I think, and allow private companies to take over parts of our water. Private corporations not only are not accountable to individuals, but they also have a profit incentive. And so they're going to be taking money as a profit. That's why we see average rates for private water systems being about 20% higher than public ones. And so, and we have information that documents all this in various jurisdictions on our website, foodandwaterwatch.org. So I think that going down that road is a very slippery way to go, and I don't think that that's the proper way for us to go in California. We've seen, if we learned anything from the recent financial crisis, Enron, et cetera, the failures of public of private water systems that have been taken back by public entities, which is what happened in Felton, California. It's that we need to keep water as a public trust in public hands, accountable to public officials.
Yes, please, Richard.
Richard Howard, we finally got something we disagree on. Great. Water is a commodity. It's like energy. There's a lifeline rate of energy that everybody has. Think of cold snaps in the northwest of this country. And the old folks get their lifeline energy, and that's the lifeline water. And, of course, that is a fundamental need. But once you go past that, your right to have a lush lawn or a dry lawn, or your right for an industry to run a car wash or to grow crops, this is a commercial operation. It's a commodity. And one of the real problems with water in California is that we haven't had enough privatization. We've got an incredible patchwork of political prices, which vary by a factor of 10 in some instances, in this vital commodity. And if you go back to the idea that California runs on energy, information, and water, energy and information are reasonably efficiently priced, and water is just not got the right price. And if you don't have the right price, you don't get the right conservation.
It's Greg Gartrell. Just to add one thing. I think we've all learned in the last year that the free market works really well until it doesn't. And putting the water system in that kind of thing, I think it can be very, very dangerous.
Okay. Thank you. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight we're talking with a panel of experts about the future of water policy in California. Our panelists are Gregory Gartrell, PhD, and Assistant General Manager for Water Resources for the Contra Costa Water District, Richard Howitt, Department Chair and Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis, and Mark Schlossberg, California Director of Food and Water Watch. I wanted to ask each of you, we sort of touched on this, but this is a fairly modest drought. We had two dry years. We've had some rains recently. I think it's almost average, pretty close to average this year. And yet we're seeing some pretty severe reactions in some places, severe impacts. I'm wondering what lessons you draw from that. How broken up are we?
Yeah, and this is Greg Gartrell. I think the very first one is not just from this, but from the studies that are being done now, shows that a lot of the agriculture that we have in this state, as well as the way we live, wasting water in many instances, is just not sustainable. Recognizing that 80% of the water in the state is used on agriculture, if you take a look at what is in the future, you take the future where, well, the delta collapses and everything has to go through a peripheral canal. If you will still want to have a salmon run, you cannot empty the Sacramento River and turn the Sacramento River into looking something like the San Joaquin River. And that is the basis of the new regulations that are running this system right now, that they're forcing more water in for fish. So you put your peripheral canal in, and what the studies show you is that you got less water than you had a couple of years ago, where they were pumping 6 million acre feet of water out of the delta every year. Your average with a peripheral canal only system would be about 4 to 4.5. That's an awful lot of acreage that's going to be lost that you would have otherwise had. In a dry year, you're even worse off. So both a wasteful lifestyle in urban areas, as well as a lot of the acreage we have in this state, just simply are not sustainable if you want to maintain species in this state like salmon.
I have a study and some of my colleagues, and it's not quite as doom and gloom as Greg. We ran a global climate change study out to 2050. We had medium warm warming. The runoff from the water and the snowpack dropped by 27%. The agriculture dropped acreage and water use, acreage by about 20%, water use by about 24%. But because we are producing those crops that people eat more of when they have better income and become more health conscious, our markets expanded, and the overall value of agriculture and the employment managed to increase despite those cutbacks. So in one way, certainly we are going to have to downsize, no question, in terms of our resource use, because global climate change is going to do this for us, and we're going to do it for urban and agriculture. But I actually am moderately optimistic about the ability to bring the Central Valley into steady state in the long run, with irrigated agriculture covering about 80% of the area it does now.
Mark Schlossberg, Food and Water Watch. The question asked, why is this so severe when there are these periodic dry periods? And there are periodic dry periods in California. It's the nature where we live. And what we see when you look at consumption, at least for urban consumers, is that in the dry periods, people can conserve. And then when the wet periods come back, people begin to use water again. And what I think we need to do is have conservation incentives that are lasting, that is a constant encouragement of conservation, and make sure that we make these changes permanent. We talked about demand hardening, the concept of not being able to decrease consumer demand because it's so low because all the conservation measures have already been adopted. But if we look at production measures, and we did this in a study that we commissioned in Marin, you see that production figures during dry periods go down, and then when it starts to rain again, it goes back up, and it goes down, it goes back up. And so there is this fluctuation, there is this flexibility, elasticity in the demand that we can take advantage of. And I think we should try and do that both in the urban areas and in the agricultural sector.
Yeah, thanks. Richard, I want to follow up because you said something interesting that you thought we could have a steady state Central Valley economy at 80% of what it's at now in terms of irrigated acreage, I think is what you were talking about. Does that mean that if you retired 20% of the irrigated acreage in the Central Valley and shifted that water to urban use, California would be in a much healthier place?
If you retired it, no, because the urbans wouldn't want it. It's way more water than they want. And you'd have downtown LA 2 foot deep, and they'd be complaining about their sewers overflowing.
Well, that would suggest that there's a lot.
But this is a logical sequence. And what we did is we ran a development of California. By the way, we had population, 92 million in 2100 and about 60 million in 2050. So we put a lot of people in the Central Valley. And there's no question we are going to gradually downsize, in my opinion, irrigated agriculture, and we'll go to urban use. But I would make one plug. Those of all of us who drive cars, how have we changed our conservation actions since gas went from $4 up to $4 and then down to $1.80 or whatever it was, $2, and then back up again? There is one thing that really makes people conserve, and there's one thing that's sincere about conservation, and that's a dollar bill.
I guess what I was wondering is, if we're wondering what the future of California's water policy is and how we get out of this cycle where a moderate drought causes extreme disruption, are transfers of water from ag to urban part of that, and how would that work?
I'm hogging the mic, but yeah. Certainly, yes, transfers from ag to urban are definitely part, because ag has more flexibility than urban. But sometimes this drought, they haven't worked nearly as well as they did in the 90s drought, partly because of hydrologic situations and partly because the fish restrictions don't let us get them through the delta.
Yep. I'd add on that. This is Greg Gartrell. And there's one other factor that came into play in a water transfer that our agency is working on, and that is environmental issues unrelated to water but directly related to terrestrial issues. When the state started the water bank, they were anticipating getting some 400,000 acre feet transferred from Northern California rice farmers who would fallow their land to those in the Bay Area and Southern California and Central Valley, San Joaquin Valley, who would buy that water. And they're ending up with about 80,000 acre feet out of that. And an awful lot of farmers pulled out because of giant garter snake issues, an endangered species, that rice fields provide habitat for, and they didn't want to get into having biologists survey their land or into mitigation measures, so that there's always something that crops up that is new and different every time you turn around. Right now, the water transfer market just does not look very viable.
Okay, thank you. This question's from the audience, and it's for Mark. Mark, the conservation efforts that you mentioned are not new, but people are not getting it. What is it going to take to truly implement water conservation measures?
Well, as Richard mentioned, it's going to take some dollars. You know, we looked at, in the study we recently commissioned in Marin, you know, we saw that there was, I guess, the toilet replacement was at about 50%. That's a lot of additional room to conserve in Marin. Same thing with clothes washers and other things. And what our point is, instead of providing all this money for these big industrial projects like desalination, we should provide people incentives to get efficient fixtures. All these fixtures are going to be replaced. A clothes washer gets replaced every like 14 or 15 years. People are going to buy a new clothes washer. We should provide them incentives so that they buy one that is very efficient, not one that is inefficient. And we should also provide lots of incentives and expertise, consultants' expertise, to do things like landscape changes. That's a huge percentage of our urban water use. In San Diego, I think like 60% of the drinking water is used for landscape. And so that's a huge area where we have a lot of room to improve and a lot of water we can save. But it's going to take sustained effort on the part of water districts who are also in an interesting situation of being at the one hand trying to get people to conserve water and at the other time relying on the dollars that people are paying for water to run their districts. So we're going to need to have sustained efforts at conservation. And if you added up all the dollars that are being spent on desalination and other types of projects like that, you could pay for a lot of conservation at a much, much lower cost. I think the marginal cost per acre foot for most of these conservation measures is under $1,000 per acre foot, which is about a third to a quarter of some of the estimates for desalination.
Or new dams, water from new dams would be probably more expensive than that.
Exactly. All those things are more expensive than conservation.
Okay. I don't know if this, I don't care if it's fair or not. could each of you give us maybe three or five things that you would be looking for as here's how, you know, we've got these problems, here's three or five things that we need to do to get out of it?
Yeah, okay, I'll start. This is Greg Gartrell. First, I think it's just been mentioned in conservation. That is the cheapest thing you can do, and it's something everyone can do. You think back to the kind of situation that Los Angeles had 20, 30 years ago with smog and the complaints when everybody started getting catalysts on their car that, why do I have to pay more for my car? Why do I have to go through this smog check? I'd only put out a little bit of pollution. Well, yeah, you do, but 3 million other people, and you put out a lot, and it's the same on water conservation. The biggest single thing you can do is probably redo your irrigation system on your house. That's where you're using most of your water. And re-landscape to more drought-tolerant types of plants that don't take. So that's one thing. That's the start, and that's something everybody can do. In terms of solving the problems we have in the Delta, there are a set of actions that have been out there and being proposed, and I think you're going to probably hear Secretary Salazar endorse those. They've been out and pushing those for about 2 years now. These include barriers in the Delta to help push flows around to keep endangered species away from the pump. We have to solve that problem. You can't sustain a system where you have there's no salmon fishing. I don't think anybody wants to see a salmon extinction, and yet even though the biological opinion points the proximate cause was the ocean conditions, the long-term cause is the decline in habitat and water system conditions in the Delta and upstream. Those have to be fixed. They can be fixed on the near term. If you're sitting around waiting for a peripheral canal, I'd suggest you not hold your breath. That's going to be a very long time. Our experience for projects in the Delta that, and I've done a number of them, totaling almost $600 or $700 million. Our experience is for every year of construction, there's 2 years of planning, design, and permitting. You got a 4-year construction project for a peripheral canal, you're looking at 12 years, and even giving credit for the 2 years that they've been studying is now just 10 years away, if there's no opposition. And we already have a situation where there's 20 to 25 lawsuits going on in the Delta right now, and that's going to be rising. I learned of a number more that are coming down the pipeline today. So dealing with the issues that we have now with projects that can help now, I think, is absolutely necessary.
Yeah. Thanks, Greg. Richard?
Richard Howitt, quickly, first thing is we've got to fix the Delta. And the long-term fix is some form of canal. And so we better start working on it. And I agree with everything Greg said about the difficulties of doing it. But if we have another dry year in 2010, we will have a sea change in the way we view water. I recently came back from Australia where they've had a really long drought, and the attitudes to water and the value of water has changed dramatically in that country. First, the canal. Secondly, we need to look at... give the environmentalists part of the pie. One of the problems with the difficulty of California water law is in-stream flows can't be, environmental flows cannot be a legal right. Therefore, we've got to find a way of giving part of the asset in the water business to the environmentalists so they have a clear incentive to independently manage what's theirs in the environment rather than block what you're doing with what's yours. Thirdly, we need to think about these problems of co-equal goals of ecosystems and water supply. And we need to think about habitat and habitat restoration and adaptation because we've changed the habitat significantly. And the final thing is, I would go back to what both Mark and Gregor said, that we need to provide incentives for conservation, simply that you have increasing block rates on water. Very low rates for the lifeline rates, all free for the first few units, and very steep if you want lush lawns. And the same, of course, for farmers.
I'll take three things, but I'm going to focus on three things that I think individuals in this room can do to improve our water situation. Number one, and you're already doing this, obviously, is getting informed, but also getting actively involved in your water issues. You can learn about what's going on from, you know, the agendas at various water districts, but also check out some of the organizations that are working on these issues. Food and Water Watch, we have a whole host of information about the problems of privatization of water, about the problems with desalination, about the need for conservation, different conservation programs. And also, most importantly, from our perspective, a clean water trust fund at the federal level. We talk about building new infrastructure, building new dams, as was mentioned, building a peripheral canal has been talked about. We have an aging existing water infrastructure, some of which was built 100 years ago. It's in desperate need of repair. In California alone, we have, I think, $10 billion worth of projects that need to be funded. The amount of funding that was provided in 2007 was $76.5 million from the federal government. And even in the recent stimulus package, it was only something a little bit over $400 million. We need to create a permanent trust fund at the federal level to make sure that our water infrastructure is improved, that we all can have access to clean water. Second, of course, we need to continue to invest in conservation. I think we've talked about that quite a lot tonight, and that seems everybody's in agreement on that. And we can conserve as individuals in our own homes, in our own landscaping, in our own lives. And the third thing is a very simple thing, and that would be I would encourage you to drink tap water and to not drink bottled water. And this sounds like a very little issue, a very small issue in comparison to these large issues with agriculture and the farms and farm workers and what's going on. But the private water companies are a very significant threat to our water resources. They're already buying up some of the precious spring water that we have in our state and in our country. They're trying to take over municipal water systems, as we've seen time and time again, which leads to higher rates, increase in spills, and worse service. And as consumers, it's a very little thing, but it's a significant thing. And it also makes us aware that we can drink from the tap. It's something we need to invest in. We don't need to be paying more for a gallon of gasoline than for water. And it's something that, as a public trust, we need to collectively work to improve. So that was one of the three things I'd recommend.
Thanks, Mark. I think we have time for one more question, if we keep them clipped. I've got a question here. It says, suppose we get a Delta fix. What else is needed? We've talked a lot about policy things. So what about infrastructure? What are the kinds of infrastructure investments that are needed?
I think the studies are very clearly showing that unless you have storage so that you can, when there is a lot of water, you can take care of yourself in the years when there isn't any, we're going to be in trouble. I think that there is going to have to be more groundwater storage and more surface water storage. It's going to have to be carefully done. I think the days of damming up rivers is kind of over in this state, has been for a long time. Offstream storage is where I think all the action is going to be in expanding reservoirs.
Quickly, Richard or Mark?
South of Delta storage, particularly underground storage in depleted aquifers. Dams are extraordinarily expensive.
Clean Water Trust Fund at the federal level to fix our aging infrastructure.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you to our panelists, Gregory Gartrell, PhD and Assistant General Manager for Water Resources for the Contra Costa Water District. Richard Howitt, Department Chair and Professor of Agricultural and Resource Economics at UC Davis, and Mark Schlossberg, California Director of Food and Water Watch. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. Remember, if you are eager to continue this conversation, join the club on the internet at commonwealthclub.blogspot.com. I'm Mike Torr, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.